Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
On this episode of Damsels in the DMs.
I think the thing that you can't teach someone is that they have something to say in a voice. And that could be in drama, that could be in comedy, it could be whatever. But I think when you're asking about the transition from short to feature, it's less technical. It's more, oh, the recognition that this filmmaker is ready to say something bigger.
This message is intended as a reminder that we are not licensed professionals, not psychiatrists or psychologists. If you have a serious problem, please seek professional help. The National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255.
There's some damsels in the DM.
Yes, queen.
Tell us what's the vibe. There's some damsels in the DM. Please tell us what's the vibe. DMs, DMs, yeah, we see them. Yeah, we read them. DMs, DMs, we don't need them. We just leave them.
Please.
Yeah.
It's going down in the DMs. Bye.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Damsels in the DMs. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Alejandro.
How are you doing, my friend? How was your holiday?
Holiday was really fun, really special. It was both restful and busy at the same time. So how was yours?
It was good. I saw both my mom and my dad, so that was really nice. Got to go to visit Brian's sister in Chappaqua and see her baby. I always joke that I think I'm more of a dog person than a baby person. And every time I hang out with a baby, I prove myself wrong. So
that's so adorable. I could so see you being so gentle and like playful with a baby. That's true.
It ended up being that, like, while everyone else is in the kitchen, my job was to entertain the baby. And, like, I never would have picked that role for myself, but I was just having the best time.
I love that. Also, too many cooks in the kitchen cannot be fun sometimes. Like,
true. So true.
So what were you doing? Were you reading? What was the activity that you found yourself most gravitating toward with the baby?
Love the reading. Oh my God, she kills me. She loves my jewelry. So she kept like wanting me to take my bracelet off and give it to her. Oh. And I mean, the girl has good taste, right? And she would take the bracelet and then I'd give it to her and I'd be like, oh, so pretty. She's like, so pretty. And then she'd be like, she. And I was like, are you trying to say chic right now? Cause you're right. Like, you are so chic.
That is phenomenal.
I'm like, you're one. Do you know how to say chic? But I think that's what you're trying to tell me right now. And then I'd be like, okay, can I have it back now? Because it's like beads. I was afraid she would break it. And she would be like, mine.
That is hilarious. Oh my God. My parents have videos of me as a baby. I remember there's one, I think it was Christmas time. It was either Christmas time or birthday or whatever. But like there was a point where I was opening a gift and I had some uncles were messing with me and they were like, oh, that's mine. And like the way that my younger self used eyes to like just show this like really like intense, like, no, it's mine. It was so, I mean, it was really funny, but it's funny how I guess mine is a universal word that all kids tend to gravitate toward.
My favorite thing about kids is just how they're so like unapologetic, you know, because like when you get to be an adult, you're like, oh no, if you want that, like, go ahead. Like, you have the first piece, you go first. Cause you're so afraid to offend people, you know? And at least I always put like others before myself on doing things. But as a kid, it's always just you.
Absolutely. No filter. No filter at all. Just like Nardeep, who was just no bar. What's the expression? No bars held.
No filter?
No filter. No, I mean, how just open and honest he was with his experience in terms of starting in acting and growing as a writer, growing as a director. I'm blown away by all that he shared today. This episode was truly magical. And you met him at Bentonville, is that correct?
Bentonville. We have another Bentonville person on the pod today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a couple things that Nardeep said that I felt like are super motivational for people who are listening to this. And, you know, you might just be starting your career in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
He talked about how he had made 10 short films before he made his feature. And, you know, a lot of people make one short film and they're like, okay, this is the one that's getting me into Sundance. This is what's getting me into Cannes. But then he talked about like the short film he made, I believe it's called Bug, led him to meeting the producers who ended up helping him to make his feature, Land of Gold. I was lucky enough to see Land of Gold, and it's incredible. It's such a beautiful film. His performance is amazing. The little girl who also stars in the film is also incredible. And he said that that was the 8th feature that he had wrote. And again, people write one feature and they're like, okay, this is my feature that I'm going to sell, and this is what's going to give me my career. And I think it's so important that like the more repetition you put in is what allows you to actually have a career that takes off in this industry.
Absolutely. Such a wise person and giving soul and just, yeah, just a really admirable journey that he's been on and an amazing trajectory he's on right now. So I'm really excited to see where his career goes.
All right, everybody. Well, let's see what he's giving today.
Let's get into it, y'all.
All right. Well, hello, Nardeep. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk.
Yes. I believe that we last saw each other in LA, but we initially met at the Bentonville Film Festival where you had your screening of your film, correct?
That is right. And you were screening your film, right? Yeah. We were doing lots of screenings in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is a surprisingly interesting place.
I know. I actually really like that festival. I thought that it was a really great experience. And, you know, who knew Bentonville, Arkansas would be the home of such a wonderful festival?
Yeah. For all you listening, to plug, Bentonville has one of the best museums in the country. I think it's called Crystal Lakes or something like that, or Crystal Rivers. It's like one of the most impressive art collections that I've ever witnessed in the middle of Arkansas. It's wild.
How did you have time to go there? Like through all of your screening and press and all the events?
You know, I've like made it a priority that if I'm going, like, you know, it's the privilege and the sort of the glamour of being able to do like the festival circuit with a movie. It's like if you're going to a place you've never been, try and explore a little bit. So so many people were like, you got to go there. So I like made it my mission to go there for at least like 2 hours to see it. Yeah.
Good for you. I did not make it to the museum, but, you know, hopefully next time.
And there will be a next time. Since
I am new to your work and you, Nardeep, I would love to know a little bit more background as far as, you know, where you're from and what you do and, you know, where you're located, but also, yeah, how you got started in filmmaking too.
All right. Yeah. I'll try and cliff note this a little bit, but hi, everybody. I'm Nardeep Kermi. I was born in Switzerland and grew up outside the suburbs of Philly and like the white suburbs of Philly. And, you know, growing up as a Punjabi American who also had like a big British influence who came from Switzerland, making friends was pretty difficult for me, particularly in these like white communities. And, you know, I started playing music and then found performing, acting as like a way in to make friends. I realized that if I could make people laugh, they wanted to beat me up less. So I started making people laugh, got into performance, started doing like the school plays, musicals, did some community theater and all that kind of stuff. And I was very fortunate in my high school. We had this class called video applications where, you know, they gave you a mini DV camera and taught you how to do basic editing on the computer. And it was like, okay, let's make short films, music videos, whatever. And I saw it as like a perfect marriage of my loves of photography. I mean, I always used to take photos and develop them and performance. So I started making short films with my friends and I did this class. And I remember it was my sophomore year. Or junior year of high school. I forget. Junior year of high school, we did Oklahoma, the musical. And I got cast as Ali Hakim, as I played him, or Ali Hakim, as is more conventionally referred to as. And it just like hit me, like, why am I, in order to be a performer in this business, as a brown person, I'm so, I'm relegated to what's available to me. And what's available to me was limited and not complex. Like I'm unless like the the production was going to be highly specific. Like, they're never going to cast me as Hamlet. You know, they're never going to let me play like these like really intense or funny or complex characters. So I think that's where like my love of filmmaking in, you know, besides watching movies all the time, but like my love of wanting to make films really started, realizing I could tell the story myself. And I applied to college and got into NYU. So I studied film at NYU, not acting. I figured I could act in people's films and, you know, keep it up there and do plays in the city if I wanted to, but learn different, you know, screenwriting, directing, cinematography, editing, all that kind of stuff. And graduated NYU in the recession, couldn't get a job, worked some really terrible graveyard shifts in New York, wound up finding myself in the fashion industry, was freelancing the fashion industry for almost 10 years, shooting and editing content for magazines that went up online. The money started to dwindle and I was like, I really miss performing. So I started auditioning again, wound up finding a home in a theater out here in LA in the same way I found theater as a home in New York. Was doing a lot of 99-seat theater in LA and found representation. And then they started sending me out. And then I was able to make inroads acting and sort of like shift my career and the way I was paying my bills acting, which is like a very unique thing. I feel I'm very fortunate to say that. And then basically anytime I was making a little bit of extra money, I put it back into my short films, rededicated it to the writing, the directing, and made a bunch of short films, a couple that did, you know, very well on the festival circuit internationally. And then that eventually led me to my first feature, Land of Gold. That's, yeah, cliff notes. Hopefully that's okay.
Cliff notes are good. We like abbreviations, but we're also here for a good tangent too. So what was the transition from acting to directing like? Or was it all just kind of like an evolution that just slowly snowballed?
Yeah, you know, there wasn't like a conscious switch of like, okay, today I'm going to do this thing. It was more like I think what you said, an evolutionary switch was it was kind of how it was. It just sort of was like, this is going to be a way to give myself an opportunity to perform. And then it grew from that where I was like, oh, I don't want to be relegated just to things that I could perform. I want to be able to do things that like I can get my friends to do, or like I have this crazy idea and I don't really care about being in it. And I love telling the story. I think the skill set, you know, I mean, if this is any indication, like in high school, I was student council president and class president and all that kind of stuff, very type A. So directing actually like fit that perfectly because like I could then be not in control, but I could help guide all of these different artists in telling the story, you know, with a point of view and with a perspective. In a way, as an actor, you kind of show up and you just do your job. You're a cog in the machine. It's a beautiful art, but it's just part of the art. Whereas with directing, you know, if you're writing, you're there from the very beginning of it till the very end of it. And like, as a director, you live with a project start to finish forever. Whereas with an actor, at least I see it this way, like I am happier in rehearsals and in the process. And I tend to not really care very much about the final product afterwards, because it's sort of like, yeah, let's move on to the next thing. So directing really like it like scratches that sort of full completion itch. But yeah, no, it was evolutionary. It started more as a way to express myself in a more complete way, and then wound up becoming, you know, the thing where I realized like, oh, this is longevity is here. And there's a different way to tell the story than just kind of participating as talent.
Yeah.
Do you solely focus on directing the stuff that you've written, or do you allow another person to come in as the director, or how do you balance that?
Yeah. If I write it, I direct it. If I direct it, it doesn't necessarily mean I've written it, but usually I'll have like my hand in the writing at some point, either like doing a revision on it or helping the writer and guiding them and like kind of notes, adjustments type deal. And I'm not acting in everything I do. It just happens that the sort of more visible projects I've done recently, I've like written, directed, and acted. But I would never want to be limited as a director just to the things I write, because I feel like that would be kind of boring. Especially like as I try to stretch myself as a you know, artist.
Right.
Yeah. Nardeep, can you remind me which high school you went to in Philly? I forgot that we had this connection.
Yeah. So outside of Philly, Downingtown High School. Yeah, Downingtown High School. And then we split our senior year. So I was Downingtown West.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where were you at?
Friend Central.
Yes, right. That's right.
On City Ave, yeah. Yeah, one thing that I've always found really remarkable about your journey is that I feel like a lot of actors today kind of pick up writing, directing later in the game, you know, realizing exactly what you realized so early on, that the roles can be super limiting because you don't have very much control over your acting career. But because you studied film in your undergrad, you already had that knowledge when you went back to acting later. What do you think that you have put into your acting from getting that education in film? And how do you think that that's informed some of the decisions you make when you're in front of the camera?
That's a good question. You know, my film background, my like behind the camera stuff has definitely informed me as a performer, particularly on camera, right? Because camera performing is different than stage performing. It's made me less precious. I think there's this thing young actors tend to do where they show up on set. They really want to give it their all, right? They want to like, this is my chance. I'm going to be seen. Everyone's going to see me this. I'm going to get cast and everything. But the reality is, if you've ever worked on a set, you know, no one cares. Like, you are just a cog in the machine. I said that earlier, right? You're just part of the process. And there's so much that comes before you and so much that comes after you. So I think, you know, me knowing all of that stuff that happens from start to finish as an actor, I go in and look at things not as like, this is my chance, but it's more like, ooh, how can I help tell this storyteller tell this story the best? How can I look at this character? How does this fit the script? How does this tell the narrative the best? It's not about me. It really isn't. Like if I get some catharsis out of what I'm doing, that's great. And that's just privately for me. But ultimately, you're trying to tell a story. So like, I never want to like get a character who may be villainous and be like, oh, how can I make, you know, obviously, how can I make them compassionate or whatever? But I'm not trying to make them not who they are and service the story, right? Like, I've heard some horror stories of actors showing up and trying to change the part because they don't want to, you know, come off this way or that way, or they don't want the, they want to be like received in a different way. And it's like, well, the beauty of performing is letting go and just being what the writing dictates you want to be and how the director interprets that and like, you know, the performance style, right? Like one of my favorite stories, Jack Nicholson's one of my favorite actors. And like, he's—
Yes. Oh my God. He's amazing. I love him too.
Yeah. He's incredible. And his performance style has varied wildly in his career. But you look at a movie like The Shining, which I think he's objectively incredible in, but someone else could say he overacts. But like, he and Kubrick and like that script, they dictated that this was what the film needed. And I think it's a masterpiece. So it's like, you know, knowing that as an actor who has been behind the camera has let me let go of my ego in ways and has forced me to let go of my ego, where I'm like, okay, you know, I'm just here to help you tell the story as and use like my body, my voice as a vessel. And how can I best service the material? Because that's what it's about, right? Like when you're on stage as an actor, you're making very fine choices because you're repeating the performance every time. And you have like a month of rehearsal at least to really mine and find those moments. When you're on a film set, if you're lucky, you have rehearsal, but like you have takes. I had an acting teacher here in LA, Stephen Book, who was like, treat every take as a rehearsal. So that was like a big thing for me. And I would like think of that as a director. I'm like, oh, right. I do want every actor to think of it as a rehearsal because I don't want you to repeat the same thing every time unless I ask you to do that. The reason we're doing takes is to get something different, unless it's like a camera problem and we have to do it again for those reasons. But the idea is like, give me something different that I can play with, because what you're doing on set isn't the final performance. We're going to create the final performance in the edit. And knowing that has allowed me again to let go, not be so tight. And it's been a journey. Like, you know, when I was younger, my acting career definitely was much tighter, but now I feel much looser and much more like, you know, it's like when you see those actor roundtables, like Cate Blanchett and like Joaquin Phoenix and Denzel Washington talking about the craft, getting in their body and all that kind of stuff. I feel like I'm finally getting to a place where I understand what they're talking about in a real way, because I'm starting to do that. And the feedback has been really great from other directors. They're like, oh, you know, they enjoy working with me because, again, I'm not trying to step on their toes, but I'm doing my work privately and trying to fit that into what it is that they want in the conversations we've had. I'm starting to ramble a little bit, but,
That was such a great answer. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that's so true, because I feel like as an actor, you feel like, oh my gosh, there's so much pressure on me to really nail this part. Like, I'm doing so much to tell this story. The film is riding on me. But really, like, you're there to serve whoever wrote the story, is directing the story, to serve their vision. So whatever you're doing, you are just helping them. And I think that that's such a great distinction on that. I'm curious for you, yeah, because you mentioned that you started doing short films, and then obviously I met you when you were taking your feature around the festival circuit, which did super well. Yeah. I want to hear a little bit about how you started transitioning from your shorts to your feature.
Yeah. Randomly. I had been making shorts for years to less success than I'd want. Experimenting with style and what I want to say and all that. And then the 2016 election happened, and sort of things kind of clicked into gear for me in terms of like, hey, I have this privilege to be able to tell stories, and I'm finding a way to make my living and live my life that way. As a brown American, hyphenate American, I think it's a privilege, but it's also, there's a little bit of a responsibility in terms of representation and what we're doing. So I made a film in response to the 2016 election called Bug, that's available on YouTube if you want to see that, about a sick American on the 4th of July during, dealing with a lot of the brown phobia, for lack of a better term, that was happening around the 2016 election and after. And I made that film not in a strategic way. I wasn't like, this is going to show off my acting, this is going to show off I'm a great director, or I, it was just because I felt like I had to say something. And it wound up being my most successful short film I've ever made. And like went kind of international, all over the place. People were really moved by it. It was a conversation starter. And that's the first, that was like, I think that was 30 when I made that, or 29, 30. And that was the first time people in earnest were like, ooh, what feature do you want to make? There was something about that film, and I think it was the perspective and point of view that people were like, we want to see a longer form project from you. Whereas my previous shorts, my film school stuff, everything, it didn't garner that interest. This one did. I made a couple shorts after that, Monogamous and Unknown Caller. But Pog was the one where I started really thinking like, okay, what is the script I'm going to write? So I started going back into my feature writing. I had written a couple features beforehand. They weren't really the right ones. I didn't really feel like they fit. Because again, I had this like thing in my head of like, I wanted to say something, or that I had something to say. And I started dreaming of what Land of Gold became, let's say in 2019. Pog came out in 2018, and Land of Gold started, the gestation of it started in 2019. And again, like Pog was ripped from the headlines, so was Land of Gold. There were these stories of these children separated at the border, and this like very inhumane immigration policy that the United States was in, again, related to the Trump administration, but also prior administrations and, current administrations have continued this policy. And I was like, ooh, this is something I can't get out of my head. I have something to say here. And then married that with my own South Asian experience and conversations I was having within the South Asian community. And that's kind of how I started writing the feature, because I think I felt like I was ready for it. I mean, I had like a decade plus of production experience. I'd been acting, I'd been making stuff. And I think it was finally like producers finally like saw that film and were like, hey, we would love to work with you. And that's how I found my first two producers for Land of Gold, Kirtan and Balavi Sastry, who you met. I think you met Balavi at Bentonville. So they approached me in large part because of that short, because they had seen that and they were really moved by it. And they're like, oh, this guy's got something to say. Again, I think that's the thing, right? Like people are like, oh, I can make a horror movie and I could be really slick with the camera and do this and do that. Anybody can do that. You can go on YouTube and watch tons of tutorials and tons of like YouTubers doing that, and they do it exceptionally well. I think the thing that you can't teach someone is that they have something to say and a voice, and that could be in drama, that could be in comedy, it could be whatever. But I think when you're asking about the transition from short to feature, it's less technical. It's more, oh, the recognition that this filmmaker is ready to say something bigger. And whatever package that might be, it still might be like a super genre fair type thing, but there still has to be that substance there. And I think, the short film is a great avenue to kind of test the waters of, do you have something to say and can you execute it? And then the feature is like obviously the next step.
That's beautiful. I love that. I mean, I feel like, there is something to say about, wanting to like put stuff out there just to have it out there. And then there's another thing on the other side of that, where it's like you have to have, like, how important is the why? What is your why? Like, why does the story matter? And like, what sort of impact do you anticipate having? And like, the mission behind it.
Yeah. What else is the point, right? Like, why else create? I mean, art is meant to comment on society, on relationships, on stuff. It's commenting on stuff. So it's like, unless you have something to comment on that you feel very strongly about, I don't know if what you're working on is going to reach the audiences you want them to, because there's nothing to receive, right? And I think I just hit a point, whether it was like maturity wise, technical wise, everything kind of married together. And finally, like, I was able to encapsulate what I was commenting on and weaponize it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So how did you meet the producers for the feature length? Was that something where they approached you, or did you approach them, or a hybrid? Yeah,
it's actually a great story. So Kirtana, so two of my producers are sisters. Kirtana, who's a casting director in LA as well, she was at a film festival where that short film played and came up afterwards and just like was very complimentary and was like, oh, I love this short. Like, you know, she's very complimentary. And I may or may not have invited myself to her birthday party that she was having in a couple weeks.
Okay.
Because I was like, cool. All right, I'm coming to your birthday. And I showed up and we became friends. And there was no like work talk. It was just like we just enjoyed each other's energy. And it was just like we became friends. I had met her sister on a completely separate occasion. And yeah. And I didn't know that they were sisters until I did. And yeah, which is great. And they had made a couple shorts. They had made a documentary and they wanted to get into narrative features. And they started reaching out to filmmaker friends that they really liked and supported, that like they really liked the vibe of them. And they reached out to me and said, do you have anything? And I was dreaming Land of Gold up, like the first instance of it. So we went out to dinner and I pitched it to them. They're like, oh, that sounds great. We'd love to read it. And I was like, I haven't written it yet. So I spent my December of 2019 writing the first draft, like spent 3.5 solid weeks just writing that first draft, wrote the end and sent it, you know, grammar, spelling errors galore. But they read it and they saw something in it. So they were like, great, we want to make this with you. And then, you know, COVID happened and I basically had a year of unemployment and like was able to like workshop that script and work on it. We were able to get our third producer, Simon Tofik, on board, thanks to a mutual friend of ours, Bhavani Rao. He really responded to the script too and thought we were doing something interesting there. And then we were starting conversations to go out to production companies and financiers. And in that process, I sent the project, you know, I sent it to all the labs, as you do, like all the labs. And I've never been the lab guy. Like, I've been applying for years and they always reject me and I never get any inch. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? Am I terrible? So I sent it to this grant called the AT&T Untold Stories Program, which is AT&T in conjunction with Tribeca Festival. And we wound up winning the thing, which gave us our production budget. And, you know, we had 11 months to make the movie because we had to premiere at the Tribeca Festival the following year. So, you know, the gestation period of the project was very short, but the producers jumped on and it was sort of like lightning. Like, it was like this project was meant to happen and it was meant to happen this way with this team. But yeah, that's how they found it. They liked my short and they reached out. And that was the first time, you know, producers had reached out and been like, hey, we would like to work with you. And, you know,
that is so inspiring.
Yeah.
That is so inspiring. And to hear that you were able to accomplish writing the feature within a month. I mean,
well, the first draft, and it was a pretty terrible first draft. It's my vomit draft, but yes.
But still, I mean, there's something to say about being able to, like, you know, bring something, an idea, to fruition, and even if it's a draft, whatever punctuation or grammar or errors, whatever it might be filled with, the fact that you completed it, I mean, that says a lot. That's really beautiful. And then it's really interesting what you're describing too, because we've talked many times with other people where it's just like the universe has a funny way of just kind of unloading everything that you ask for at once. And then it's just like, well, the universe is like, are you ready? Can you do this?
Yeah. You know, it's like the first draft may have taken a month, but it was like a year plus of dreaming and thinking. You know, that short came out in 2018. That's around the start time I started thinking about it. 2019 was really like thinking and thinking and thinking and then putting it to pen to paper. And a lot of friends, a lot of support along the way of like putting my, you know, I think the thing that I did differently with this project, it also coincides with like my current relationship. Like, I started dating my now fiance around the same time. And I think I made this like decision in my life, like, hey, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I've been doing that for years. So let's change how I'm operating here, right? Let's not work in a vacuum anymore. So with this idea, I started telling it about it to friends, and like someone would be like, oh, have you read this article? Or have you seen this? Or I thought of your idea. And suddenly I was getting all of these different ideas from all these different sources from people, because I wasn't working just like inside here and here and like, you know, twisting and turning. I was putting it out in the universe that like things were happening. And I was also putting out my shorts, so people knew that I was like creating constantly, right? I think that's something that's really important. It's just to keep creating and putting stuff out there, because then people know you're making stuff and they're like, ooh, this person is making something. We want to make something too. But yeah, you know, I think Pallavi and Kirtana, and then later Simon, and I think the Land of Gold story is a testament to finding support and community, because you can't do this alone. And I think the only reason I've been able to get to the point that I am is the support of the people around me, and they're a huge part of that. And like, it was the first time on a larger scale, like I had support on my short films, you know, but my friend Sachin and my friend Patrick and like my DP Chris has been with me through since college, right? Like these are some of my best friends, my friend Julie, but having support in like from all of these places is what really makes things happen. And I think that's like not something that inherently just comes to you. I think you have to seek that out and seek those people that are going to support you so that you can support each other through the madness, because this is a maddening journey.
Yeah. Nardeep, there's something that you said to me when we had coffee that's really stuck with me while I've been in film school and working on my own films. And yeah, it was about, there was a scene in your film that I believe your fiance was acting in that you cut from the film. And you said that the reason that you cut it was because it wasn't serving the story, because the film really wanted to be with your character and with the little girl. And you said that the reason that you had to make that choice was because you put the film first and what was serving the story and who the relationship we wanted to be with and who the audience was empathizing with at that moment. I'm curious for you, because I'm going through a pretty tough editing process right now. And because you made so many short films, how do you make those tough editing decisions, particularly when you're acting in it?
It wasn't just my fiance. So I cut her down a little bit in a scene. I cut everybody that was a friend of mine, wound up getting cut in some way, shape, or form in that movie. And I got cut too. Yeah, those tough decisions. You know, look, you're telling a story and you're trying to find the most concise, clear way to tell that story. You know, if we were making TV, there'd be plenty of opportunity for tangents. And some people have seen Land of Gold and are like, oh my God, I would love to have seen the miniseries version of this, because of like to have more time with all these characters. And I take that as a badge of honor. Like, yeah, great. I wrote great characters. But like the wife character, right? I cut some of her out. I cut some of the mom out. I cut some of the, you know, these random characters here or there. Because ultimately, as you're editing it and you're watching it, there's the movie you write, there's the movie you shoot, and then the movie you've got. And I think your goal as a filmmaker in post-production when you're editing it is to really do everything you can to make it as concise and as short as possible. And that feels kind of like, that may sound like something that's like fighting the creative instinct and process, because you're like, make it as short as possible. But what I mean by that is that if it's extraneous, it should probably go. And regardless of your emotional attachment to the people that are involved, like as a director, you've directed these actors, you've directed these people, and, you know, you want to keep them in there, right? You know, but if the story is slowing down and it's not servicing what you're emotionally involved with, then you kind of have to get rid of it. There's a famous story of Terrence Malick with A Thin Red Line. Adrian Brody, he got cast in that film. It was going to be his breakout, right? He was the lead in this movie. Terrence Malick, artist, big cast, World War II, goes to the premiere. No one told him that Terrence Malick had re-edited the movie and he was no longer the lead of the movie. He was just a supporting character that had two lines of dialogue or three lines of dialogue, whatever it wound up being.
Damn.
The next year, he wound up winning an Oscar for The Pianist. He's fine. But I think that goes to show you that, like, it's your job as a filmmaker is to make those tough decisions of what's going to service your story best, right? So like, yeah, those scenes that I cut of the mom, of the wife character, of Caroline, of me, of sister-in-law, brother, you know, everyone had scenes that were cut. It was, for me, it's always about pacing. Because like, what is the emotional journey we're on? What are we tracking here? And if we're starting to dip, and we like the dips are fine, but if we dip too far, then we lose what we were actually on the journey of. And it's like, then I have to get the audience back on board. So I think, I mean, it's kind of an esoteric answer, but you kind of just have to protect your story, and you have to protect what your story mm-hmm. wants to be, because you may have intended it to be something, and then it may want to be something else based off performances, based off of the shooting style, based off the pacing. You know, you may have shot it in a way that makes it want to be very like slow and patient, which means you may need less tangents because you need to really sit with what's going on. But if you decide you want to fast pace it, it might mean there are other things that can be in there or not. Then there's a clarity thing. So I'm very much a proponent of like, you know, and I have a challenge with this. Like, could there have been more that could have been cut from all these movies? Maybe. I'm happy with what we wound up with. But like, again, it's also then personal taste, right? Like, what do you like and does this work for you? But I don't know if that answers that. It's kind of like rambling a little bit, but yeah.
Like we said, we love a good tangent. We never think consider rambling at all. It's never rambling.
Editing is hard. So, I mean, you also said, like, you know, I'm in the film, right? So, like, it'd be very easy for me to be like, oh, this is just such a good look. Like, this look is just like, oh, I look, this man who's me, it just looks so good. But the reality is, like, if I kept all those moments in, it would have fucking ruined the performance that is working. Mm. I think it's like the lesson that I've learned is it's not about having every Oscar winning moment in the movie. It's about building up to the one or two moments because it's a long form story, right? With a feature, and with a short, it's the same thing. My short film Bug, I was in that as well. And it all leads up to one scene at the end. And if you're still on the journey by the end, it's going to punch you in the face. And Land of Gold is very similar. It's a very slow burn until the end. So, you know, when you're doing that kind of thing, it's like really like, okay, you can't have too many peaks because you have to get the audience to go so that you can break them or whatever. So, you know, it's really learning pacing and trusting your instincts, but then also not being shy of like, this isn't working the way I want it to work, or it's working great, but it's unnecessary. I mean, the big cut from Land of Gold, I had scripted in a completely different opening for the movie. We shot it and we cut it, I think, we edited it 42 different ways and it just wasn't working for me. So I scrapped it and we redid the entire opening of the film with what we had. And it worked so much better for me because the original opening wasn't emotionally setting me in the right space. And it was like raising a lot of questions that the film wasn't prepared to answer, which was surprising to me, right? Because on paper, that scene, people were like, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. So I had to like look at the edit, look at the footage I have and be like, okay, we're going to change this and we're going to be a little creative here. And I don't think no one misses that scene for sure. I for sure as hell don't, you know.
I mean, and that 42 was, takes, 42 revisions. My goodness, yeah. I think I'd be sick of it too.
Yeah, exactly. My editor and I were just like, yeah, so this has got to get cut now, right? And we're like, yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up because I wanted to ask you, like, tell us a lot about how you direct yourself while you're acting. I find it incredibly hard, but I'm interested in what your take on it is.
Yeah. So in my I mean, the long and short of it is surrounding your support is the answer, right? Like it's surrounding yourself with people you trust. So my DP, Chris Lowe, is one of my best friends. He's a director himself. Great director. He's great DP. We've known each other for almost two decades now. We've known each other since college. And, you know, we kind of have a really beautiful language together at this point where we don't have to say too much. We just know what we want right from each other. And I trust him behind the camera implicitly. Like we talk about it. We talk about references. We talk about the shot list, the storyboard. He'll show me a frame. I'm like, good, let's go. Like there's not too much deliberation there at this point. And that's years of experience and trust, right? Mm-hmm. Surrounding myself with team members, you know, my UPM line producer, Julie Bersani, is like one of my ride or dies, right? I trust her to take care of the set, to take care of me. With the shorts, it was a bit easier to direct myself because it's a shorter form thing and I kind of knew what we had. It was only like 2 or 3 days of production. Mm-hmm. the feature, there was no way in hell I was going to be able to do that, because we also had a 9-year-old, you know, Caroline Valencia, who's our second lead of the film, gives a knockout performance, and I needed to be available to be able to be present with her, but then also direct her and then remember what she was doing, because, you know, we had to send her to school and then I'd have to perform against the tennis ball or someone. So I hired an acting coach, and it's actually my fiance, Kate Kugler, who's also an actor in the film, but she was our acting coach on set. So it's kind of like a three-headed Cerberus, like this three-headed monster that helped create the central relationship in the film, because, you know, Kate and I had lots of conversations about the script, about what I wanted from each scene, how I was building that arc and pacing it through the course of the film. And she knew what I was looking for. So when I was acting, she was my eyes behind monitor as my coach, and was like, okay, great, you did this, maybe try this. Or, okay, you want to do this, but you maybe didn't deliver it that way, maybe try something to do this. So like, we were kind of working together on my performance in that sense. When Caroline was off set, Kate would play Caroline because she was watching her performance, and then would recreate it as best as she could, so I could react to it, so I could have options in the edit to cut them together. And like, the greatest compliment I get in the film for me is that the chemistry between my character and Caroline's chemistry is so vibrant. And I think that's because of this three-headed monster. And Kate is a massive, massive reason why that happened. And I trust her, right? I trust her as like, as an artist. She's an amazing writer and director and an actor herself. And like, you know, again, I trust her to see what I'm trying to do. And then as an actor, I know I wrote it. So like, I kind of know what I need to make it work. And then it's about adding those little nuances that make it more interesting than just like, you know, going by the numbers and giving you the normal thing. It's like, what kind of things are interesting? And, you know, for me, body work is very important. So I held myself in a very physically different way. And when I would walk on set, I'd retain that body. Like, my mannerisms slowed down, my speech patterns slowed down for him. I was able to click into him and then like let go of my ego of like, there's a right, like you were talking about, like, what is behind the camera help you as an actor? With this thing, I was like, we don't have any time for me to deliberate. So it's just like, take, great, move on. Average was about three takes. But it's just like, let go and just go do it and trust that everyone's trusting me to do this crazy thing. So, you know, run with it and have fun. So, you know, having that support, like having people that you've worked with, that you've trust, that you can build those relationships with, that you can say things that are not going to necessarily fight you. They'll make you better, or they'll suggest things that make it better or easier. And then for the feature, it was having an acting coach on set, and Kate was my secret weapon.
What an amazing gift, and congratulations to you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
When are the nuptials planned for?
Oh God. Have you talked to my mother? We're in the beginning stages of planning. Thank you. Yeah, hope maybe 2025, I think, seems reasonable. venues book up fast.
It's true.
Yeah, that is very true.
So I want to go back to you know, as you're evolving in acting and slowly blending into directing, are there any resources that you would recommend to listeners to tap into if they're, you know, first time anything?
Sundance Collab is really great. Yeah. They do a lot of great classes that are super helpful. Film Independent is an organization to definitely follow and jump on board, because they do a lot of like development labs and things to get people, you know, short film labs, things like that. They're great. Some great books, like Sidney Lumet's, I think it's called Making Movies, is like classic, like a Bible of filmmaking, the treasure trove. Watch a bunch of shit you like, watch a bunch of shit you don't like. So you can analyze to see why you don't like it and what you would do different and do different. I would suggest, if you love a film and you've seen it a couple times, download the script and read the script while you watch the film and see what's different, what's similar, how the director interpreted the script. Cause like, even if they wrote it, you know, it's like the way you see it is different than how they did it. Or did they do it exactly as written? Or, you know, like, how did they interpret that script? I always think is a really great exercise. That's something that I used to do a lot. And like, honestly, I mean, it feels kind of like easy to say, but it's like, make something. I don't think you can learn all the theory you want, but like being on set and making something and like, Lauren, as you're saying, like, how do I go through this edit and like cut an actor that I don't want to cut? You know, I've heard stories of people on features who've cut complete actors and you never even know that that actor was on set because they're not in the movie, because that's what they had to do to make the film work. Like, I think making stuff, even if it's not like grand, like you don't have grand ideals for it, but let's just like, I just want to make something with my friends. And like, man, these new iPhones, they shoot log. They're amazing. Like, you can do everything with these new iPhones. Like, just get together, write like a 2-3 page script scene, two actors in a room or three actors and like whatever, and go make something and start exploring. How do you edit? How do you, what's your performance style, right? Because every director likes a different type of performance. And how do you start interpreting things? How do you see the world? I think that's something that people need to do before they show up on set, is start developing their visual aesthetic, because it's a visual medium, right? You know, those are the kinds of things I would recommend. Yeah, read a lot.
Speaking of grand, tell us what it was like being the grand prize winner at Tribeca. And yeah, also, what's next on your film slate for you?
Yeah, that was crazy. It was an honor, and it was a little out of body, if that makes sense. You know, like, you make something and you hope it resonates with people, and then it does, and you're like, thank God. But like, to be perfectly honest, I was in the mode of like, shit, is this going to play? Is this going to work? Like, are people going to laugh? Are people going to cry? Like, what? Like, I feel like I almost didn't even get to enjoy it in the way that you would expect to enjoy, because I was so like, oh, is this thing going to work? But it felt really good. It felt like recognition that, you know, the last 10, 15 years of doggedly pursuing this thing in various forms was worth it, and that, you know, I should keep doing it. I think that's what it really was. And not that you need that validation, but I think I personally needed that validation a little bit. It felt good. But I mean, this is also something I feel like might be good for your listeners to learn. Like, we all have the dream of winning the Oscar or the Emmy or the Tony or being an EGOT. None of that stuff is going to fulfill you or make you happy, because ultimately the only thing that's going to make you happy is creation and keeping making it, right? Like, you're going to make stuff that people love. You're going to make stuff that people hate, and you're going to make stuff that people are mixed on. And like, any great artist is going to go through that journey. And I think like, the awards are fine and they're great, and I see it as a way to celebrate the cast and the crew that helped make it happen, so that they're validated. Like, hey, look at this cool thing that we all made together. But ultimately, like, if I'm being honest, like, they're almost a distraction from like the art of creation, because now you're like, suddenly there's like this like metric or this rule that, or like this rubric that it's like, okay, if you win this thing, that means that you're a good artist or whatever. And it doesn't mean jack shit. Like, there are plenty of amazing artists that make, and storytellers that make great stuff that don't get those accolades. And we love that stuff, right? So it's like, it was great, but I'm doing my best to not give it power, because it's shouldn't have any power, if that makes sense. Maybe not the answer you expected.
What is within your power to, what are you manifesting next? What are you anticipating writing or directing?
As the sun shines rays on my face.
As it beautifully shines upon your face, my goodness. The universe is saying, yes, tell us more.
I'm developing a TV show right now that's an adaptation of a manga and anime from Japan. So now that the writer's strike ended like a month ago, I got to get back on that thing. And, you know, if all goes to plan, we'll be pitching that in January and February to all like the big hitters and whatever. So if all goes to plan, that'll get sold, and I'll be writing a pilot for the TV show, and then hopefully writing a whole ass TV show, which is a romance set in high school and the classical music world, which I'm very excited about. Yeah. And then
how did you stumble upon the
okay. So during COVID, I moved in with my now fiance, and you know, I've had depression since I was 16. And one of the ways I self-medicate is watching anime. I love anime. I've always loved them. I'm an anime head. But I'm of the age, like, now anime is super cool. Like, Michael B. Jordan can say like he loves Naruto, and everyone's like, oh, Naruto is the best, and like whatever. But when I grew up, no one would ever want to have sex with me. if they knew I was watching Dragon Ball Z and Cowboy Bebop. It's just like, now it's cool. Back then it wasn't. So I'm like socialized that way. So my fiance walked in the room when I was watching an anime. It was like a volleyball anime called Haikyuu, which is beautiful. And I was watching on this iMac and I turned the computer violently when she walked in the room, because I'm like, oh, she's not going to want to have sex with me if she knows I'm watching anime. And she's like, what are you watching? God. And I was like, porn. Because she's so sex positive that I was like, she'll be cool with that. So she's like, okay. And then walked away. And I was like, I got to introduce her to this thing that I love. So I introduced her to this anime, and she fell in love with it. I thought it was a good gateway one because she plays piano and it's about a classical pianist. Put the things you love out into the world. You know, one of them will hit. That's all you really need is like one yes, right? Because you'll get countless no's, but you just need the one or two yeses.
I love that story.
And that you tried using porn as a cover up for that. That's hilarious. I mean,
you know, you got to do what you got to do.
I mean, those are teachable moments.
Yeah. But yeah, other than that, I'm writing what I'm hoping will be my next feature, which is a love story set in the 1920s between a Punjabi man and a Mexican woman on the eve of the Asian Exclusion Act. So we'll see if that pans out. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Sending many positive and productive vibes on, yes, that, on both stories.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm feeling like the creative juices are flowing now. You know, like Land of Gold came out on HBO Max in May, and like we had like a festival, like a full year of that, and then now it's distributed and people can see it whenever they want. But like, it's taken me some time to like decompress from that whole experience. Like we said, it was lightning, but it was like a lot and very like, it was just like 0 to 100, 50,000 miles per hour. So now I'm like finally settling. The strike, writer strike's over. We'll see if the actor strike officially will end, or if we go back on the picket lines. I don't know what's going to happen with the vote, but the creative juices are finally starting to flow again. So I'm like back to like writing in my notebooks and sketching and writing and dreaming, and yeah, hopefully something will stick soon.
So, Nardeep, I'm curious for you, like, you know, writing can be a really lonely profession.
Yeah.
What are some like healthy habits, or do you have a morning routine? Like, what allows you to stay in this industry that we know is like full of lots of really high highs and really low lows?
Yeah, you know, I'm honestly actively trying to figure that out for myself. I think that's like always changing, you know. We don't have, I mean, some of us have 9-to-5s. I'm fortunate I don't have a 9-to-5, so I don't have a schedule. So working out is really important. Like I try and create a schedule with like working out and eating healthy, meal prepping, trying to do the best I can to go on like date night and live. We've got a dog. He keeps me young. He's the best guy in the world. But in terms of the writing, it's trying to do a little every day opposed to a lot every 5 weeks. You know, I'm a vomit writer. So like as you said, like, oh shit, like the first draft of Land of Gold in 1 month, that's insane. That is fairly normal for me. Like when I do decide to write something, I'll vomit it out. But there's been like months and months and months of dreaming and prep before that to lead up to like the first words going on paper. So I try to give myself an hour or two a day where it's purely dedicated to writing. It's whether that's dreaming or sketching or just writing random scenes, like nothing concrete, nothing structured. It's just all unstructured writing. Mm-hmm. And then if there's structured writing that can happen during that time, I run with it. And if it's like, if I go over that hour I've given myself or 2 hours I've given myself, great. But it's more just like I have an hour set aside a day, 2 hours set aside a day to lock myself with my pen and my notebook and just like train that muscle, because it is a muscle. And like the more you do it, the better you get. And I know a lot of people hate this because they want their first thing or second thing to be perfect. But, you know, Land of Gold was like my eighth feature I wrote through the course of like the last 20 years. And that's the one that went. And I, you know, I hope that my next feature will be even stronger than Land of Gold. So, yeah, I think it's trying to figure out a schedule for yourself that works for you. And for me, that's like working out to exercise the body and then giving myself time to exercise the mind. But it's also like work, that hour or two could also be watching a movie or reading a book, because it's also about like, I use the expression filling the tank. Like you can't create if your tank's not full. So it's like refill that tank with stuff you love, stuff that inspires you, you know, the photograph, the painting, whatever, the news article. the book, whatever that is, fill your tank so that once you're ready to get like really down to the nitty gritty of writing, which is like, as I don't actually like the act of writing too much. I feel like
me neither.
Yeah, it's like it's a fickle mistress. But if my tank's not full, I really f-ing hate it. But if my tank's full, then it's like, oh yeah, okay, I feel a little bit more like jazzed to do it because like I'm inspired, you know. So I think those are the sort of things that I try to do.
The fickle mistress. That's hilarious. I love it. But please, on that note, what is the funniest, wildest, or most intriguing or inspiring DM that you've ever received? Perhaps from the fickle mistress.
I won't talk about her. actually, okay, so he knows this, so I can say this, I think. So look, I'm a brown dude. Like, I don't know, I'm not getting DM'd left and right like that, right? But with Land of Gold, I was starting to get DM'd by people, which was really cool, like people who loved the film and really responded to it. The coolest one, though, there's a rapper who I was a huge fan of growing up and still am. And he was like a big influence on me growing up. He's a South Asian rapper from New York, and he was one of the first like South Asian rappers that I was aware of. And he slid into my DMs and was like, yo, I just saw your film. I loved it. I shared it with my mom. She loved it. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, and I was like, you're a legend. Why are you DMing me? He's like, you're a legend. I loved your movie. And I was like, this is sick. And last time I was in New York, we actually met up for coffee, and we've become friends since. So that meant a lot to me, because not only was it like someone responded to the film and the work and heard what I was trying to put out in the world, but it's also someone that I have been inspired by, you know, and has been so like we were like mutually inspiring each other, which is like a really unique, crazy feeling. And I hope you guys, all your listeners, at some point get a version of that. And I'm excited to have more versions of that, because like that was pretty cool. That was my favorite. That's my favorite DM I've had from Land of Gold so far.
That's an amazing story. What a cool full circle moment.
Go listen to his music. Next, his name's Heems. Is his name Heems? Check him out on Spotify. He also has a group called Sweatshop Boys, and he helped start. And he was Das Racist. He's like, this dude's a legend. But yeah, listen to
maybe
his
we
music.
Can add his songs to the background of your clips that we put all over social media.
That would be sick.
That would be sick. Dope.
Yeah.
So, Nardeep, our DM of the week asks, if you could only pick one for the rest of your life, would you pick acting or directing?
Guidance counselor. chef. Chef. Plead the fifth. Look, gun to my head, I actually do know the answer to this, and it would be directing. It would be directing. I love acting. I think I'm pretty good at it. It's so much fun. But as a director, I can tell the story the way I want to tell it. And I think directing allows me, look, I'm a photographer. Like, I know I could have been a pretty good cinematographer. I'm a pretty good editor. You know, I know how to do all these different things. And I think directing allows me to do all that with people that I'm inspired by and collaborate in this really beautiful way to make something together and kind of just be like a guide or a general or whatever you want to call it, like the leader of this group. But it's like people who are better at their jobs than I am and can help tell whatever the thing is that we're telling together better. As an actor, I love it. I mean, my heart as an actor is on stage. Mm-hmm. So I would probably pick directing just because it allows me to use more of my, allows me to put more of myself into something in a different way and work with different people in a different way than just acting would. That being said, I can't choose one or the other because I think one begets the other. Like, like straight up, if I'm being like totally vulnerable here, when I moved to LA, I had quit acting and my work as a director really suffered. And I couldn't write a damn thing. And when I started getting back into acting, suddenly the ideas started coming back and I was writing again. And suddenly I was like, oh yeah, I want to tell this story. I want to tell that story. And I started directing again. And the directing got better, sharper, more interesting. And I think, you know, for multi-hyphenates, like y'all are multi-hyphenates, like I think it's hard to choose one or the other because they all beget the other. And they all inform the other. And that doesn't mean we have to be doing the same thing on each project, right? Like, I'll happily direct something I don't write and that I'm not starring in. And I happily act in things I'm not directing. But I like doing them all because then I can scratch all the itches. But yeah, gun to head, call me a director.
I love it.
I love it. I love it. I appreciate that too, where it's like it one informs the other and in a really beautifully reciprocal way. And
yeah,
it's, I think that's really beautiful.
Just different ways to look at stories, right? Like as an actor, you read a script differently than you do as a director. Lauren, you're learning this in film school, right? Like the way you analyze a script is very different as a director than as an actor. And as a director,
you
Right?
Well, I'm about to start a feature that I'm acting in tomorrow, actually.
Congrats.
And thank you. And it's been really funny because I'm the lead in it, which is awesome. And I'm having such a great time exploring the character, but studying producing, I'm also looking at the script like, you know, I don't know about that decision. Like some changes that I would suggest, but you know, obviously like I would never, ever, ever, because I'm here to tell that person's story. Right. But it is funny how, like, when you start doing multiple different things, like it's hard to turn one brain off and only leave the one on, you know?
Totally. And I think that's like the like you'll get to your happy place where when you get on set, you just let go and you get to just be an actor and you're like, it's not my problem. I just get to be here and I just get to say these lines and move my, you know, put this cup down 17 different ways. Yeah. But then like you'll get off set and you'll be inspired and you'll probably write something new and you'll probably be like, I want to direct this thing now. Like it's such a beautiful cosmic mystery how this stuff just like informs each other.
I don't know, Nardeep. I think I'll be calling you to direct it. Not really a director.
We'll talk. We'll talk.
But thank you so much for coming on today. Can you please tell our listeners where they can stay up to date on everything that you're working on?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me on Instagram at Nardeep Thoughts. Nardeep Thoughts is where you can follow me on Instagram. And then you can see Land of Gold on Max, formerly HBO Max, if you've got that, Land of Gold. I think that covers it.
Thank you so much for being here. It was so wonderful getting to hear about your journey and getting to reconnect with you.
Thanks for having me. It was such an honor to speak with you, and good luck and congratulations to you and your loved one.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was great.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Damsels in the DMs.
Please, we are waiting for your DMs, your voicemails, your letters of feedback. We also are super excited to see you rate and review the podcast anywhere you access pods.
Yes, please do that, as it allows us to continue bringing you content from these amazing individuals. So thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Damsels in the DMs.
Until next time,
it's going down in the DMs.
Bye.
Bye.
DMs, yeah, we see them, yeah, we read them. DMs, DMs, we don't need them, we just leave them.
Please.
Yeah.
It's going down in the DMs. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.